Hi, everyone. For those of you just joining, welcome to the Dialogues event on U.S. regional cooperation on COVID-19 with Congresswoman Donna Shalala. The event will now get started. So I'll turn the call over to our moderator, Michael Shifter. So Michael, whenever you're ready.
Great. Thank you, Sophia. And good morning. I'm Michael Shifter, the president of the Inter-American Dialogue, and I want to welcome and thank you for joining our conversation that will focus on the coronavirus pandemic and the possible collaboration between the United States and Latin America and the Caribbean. Today's call is the second in a series of virtual events the Dialogue is organizing on the coronavirus in Latin America and the Caribbean. We hope you'll want to stay informed about future sessions by opting into our outreach list on our website, thedialogue.org. Next week, we have three calls that we'll be having on this topic, one focused on energy, another on remittance flows, and a third on the Venezuela crisis. We will also set up a page on our website devoted to this topic, thedialogue.org/COVID-19. It is updated daily with relevant and informed analyses and commentaries about the impact of the coronavirus in the Americas. This pandemic is the overriding issue today, as all of us in the Americas face a public health and economic and social crisis of unprecedented proportions. Governments throughout our hemisphere are pursuing different approaches to confront and address this colossal challenge. Clearly, the well-being of citizens is the most urgent priority at the national, state, and local levels. In the United States, last week, the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, which provides free coronavirus testing, paid leave, enhanced unemployment insurance, among other services, was enacted into law. The House of Representatives now is focusing on a bipartisan deal supported by Senate leaders and the Trump administration on a nearly $2 trillion emergency relief package that will assist business and millions of Americans amid a virtual halt of the U.S. economy. As the number of cases continues to increase throughout the Americas and governments naturally turn inward, it is nonetheless important to explore the possible role of the United States in fostering greater cooperation and developing a serious assistance program, despite the limitations. Working with partners in this hemisphere and throughout the world is the best way to combat this pandemic and should be part of any overall strategy. There's no one better to help shed light on this question than Congresswoman Donna Shalala, who brings vast experience and a unique perspective. Congresswoman Shalala was elected in 2018 and is currently the U.S. representative for Florida's 27th congressional district. She has also been a member of the Dialogue since 2001, I'm proud to say. Congresswoman Shalala was the longest serving Secretary of Health and Human Services in U.S. history during the Clinton administration. In addition to a remarkable background in health policy, academia, and public service, she was also president and CEO of the Clinton Foundation and served as president of the University of Miami. I've asked Congresswoman Shalala to give opening remarks, which will be followed by a question and answer session. Listeners can submit questions on Twitter using our hashtag COVID-19 and LATAM, or by emailing meetings@thedialogue.org. Congresswoman, we are delighted and privileged to have you with us and so grateful you were able to fit us into your very busy schedule. Thank you so much. I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you very much, Michael. And thank you for hosting a very timely call. This morning, everybody woke up and to the welcome news that the Senate passed a $2 trillion rescue bill. We will pass it in the House probably by voice vote, and the president will sign it this week. While I've been a member of the Dialogue, I'm actually a freshman member of Congress, and I actually represent the city of Miami and most of Miami-Dade County, which is often referred to as the capital of Latin America. We've been watching this virus spread from China to the Middle East, to Europe, to the United States, including devastating impact on South Florida, and now it's virtually all over Latin America. We have 2,000 confirmed cases in Florida, but there are 2,000 confirmed cases in Brazil, over 1,000 in Chile, more than 400 in Colombia, and of course, we're all watching Venezuela. They say that they've got 100 confirmed cases, but who knows how large the actual number is. Last year, I went to the Venezuelan-Colombian border, and I visited a hospital and met with frontline healthcare workers. They didn't have the basic medical supplies they needed to address routine visits. They're overwhelmed with Venezuelans, let alone a global pandemic. We all have deep concerns about the Maduro's regime ability to meet the health needs of the Venezuelan people, but I'm also worried about the rest of Latin America, which has absorbed huge numbers of Venezuelans, particularly Colombia and Peru. The Senate bill and the two previous coronavirus-related bills will help us combat the horrible economic and health impacts of the coronavirus. But frankly, it's not enough to even spread, even stop the spread here in the United States, let alone stop the spread around the world. Our first emergency funding bill gave the CDC emergency funds for its international operations, and the State Department under USAID also was given funds for global health programs, for disaster assistance, for economic support. USAID has released about $62 million of that money out of their emergency reserve fund for contagious infectious disease outbreaks. That's nowhere near enough. And the U.S. has a long history of robust federal aid for public health, and our experts have worked with their international counterparts. We are, the CDC has full-time staff in the Americas, and they work very closely with PAHO and, of course, with its umbrella organization, the World Health Organization. But I'm deeply concerned about the Americas for a couple of reasons. The silver lining is that the Americas have a bit of a head start in trying to contain the virus, But given the nature of their health systems, they have much lower health system capacity. They have fewer intensive care units and ventilators, and people in the Americas have less of a possibility to wash their hands frequently with soap. And the lack of personal protective equipment called PPE is evident. The CDC and PAHO have put out incident management teams for the Americas, but they simply don't have the resources to be able to help many of the countries. Though the one thing to acknowledge is that the CDC has trained much of the leadership in public health in the Americas. So they have good contacts, and they have excellent ways of giving people advice and working with PAHO. But the lack of PPE, personal protective equipment, and the fact that the United States and Europe are buying up everything they can find, is going to mean a very slow response in the Americas. I'm particularly concerned about the fact that the internet, most people in the Americas cannot work from home because of their lack of access to the internet and the nature of the jobs that they had before. Here, we're literally putting $2 trillion out to pay people to stay at home. We're going to capture their incomes and give them the money to stay at home. That's not possible in the Americas. So we have some real challenges, and it will take both the business community as well as the U.S. government and governments all over the world that are related to Latin America to make an enormous effort. But the economic realities and the large role of the informal economy, we all should have serious concerns. Let me end there, Michael, and I'd be happy to answer any questions to the extent I can.
Great. Thank you very much, Congresswoman. That was terrific. Just to maybe follow up with a question or two. I mean, what is your sense of in Congress now about the level of interest or the openness to have develop a serious assistance program and take a leadership on that in the Americas. Is there a will or what is your sense?
I think there's an interest in the House of Representatives led by Elliot Engel and Nita Lowey. Nita Lowey, the chair of appropriations, has had a long interest, and she's held the state portfolio herself because of her desire to make sure that the United States continues its global leadership. Whether the U.S. is prepared to put more money into WHO, I was very unnerved by the president's comments yesterday about WHO, where he said, well, I've heard things about WHO. And then Tony Fauci had to get up and talk about the very strong leadership leader that WHO currently has. We are their largest donor. Whether you're asking whether we're prepared to put more money into PAHO, certainly the CDC is prepared to do everything it can in the Americas, but it will have financial limitations. I will be talking to my House colleagues about what we need to do in the Americas for our next bill. We've done some things, as you well know. I'm very unnerved by the fact that Mark Green has announced, the head of USAID, who is a good guy. I knew him from Wisconsin when he was a state legislator, and he was a solid appointment at USAID. I'm unnerved that he's announced that he's going to be leaving. I'm hoping that the White House and the Secretary of State can convince him to stretch his time out a little more. So, yes, there are a group of us that are interested, a bipartisan group. What we will do on the next bill, I can't predict.
Okay, thank you. On the CDC, what particularly would be the contribution? What are they doing with their regional counterparts and health experts in the region? Are there best practices, or do we have any sense of what's most effective?
Yes, it'll be best practices, what they're learning about the disease itself, who it targets, and what the Americas need to do to focus what resources they have on those targets. They will also be explaining very carefully the clinical research that's going on around the world to try to identify not simply the vaccine, which will take 2 years out at least, but treatments. And they are every day talking to their counterparts in the Americas about what they know, about what they can do with what they have, and about leadership questions.
Great. Thank you. We've gotten a lot of questions from our listeners, Congresswoman, so maybe I'll turn to those questions if that's okay. First one is, what are the potential long-term COVID-19 impacts on our health, public health system? What gaps in our health system has the pandemic exposed?
I think it's exposed a number of gaps. Let me say this, that 30 years ago, at a conference that former President Gerry Ford hosted in Colorado, I literally debated Jean Kirkpatrick on whether health was a national security issue and an international security issue. She argued traditionally that it wasn't. And I argued that it was. And I was using, of course, the potential of pandemics, but also AIDS, HIV/AIDS as an example, which had where it's already devastating international armies. That was a wake-up call, it seems to me. And when John Bolton got into the NSC, he actually did not believe that health was that important. And so the Global Health Group, which was about 20 people in the NSC, was literally abolished. And that was a very dangerous precedent, even though we had been warned by the intelligence officials early in January that this pandemic was coming. So rebuilding that piece, the NSC, the State Department, in addition to major investments in the great scientific agencies, the Food and Drug Administration, the National Institutes of Health, and the CDC, which has been particularly decimated in terms of their international funding and staff is important. But here's what we've learned, and we knew it years ago. The best investments we can make are in state and local health departments. They are the people on the front line. And we're talking about public health. We're talking about departments of public health at the local level and at the state level, and the laboratory facilities they need to catch the viruses early, to contain them. And this is not only viruses, this is food safety as well. And we have not made those kinds of investments for years, because frankly, every time I testified on this, I used the term public health infrastructure and people's eyes glazed over. It didn't get them as excited as cancer. And so that is a weakness in our healthcare system, in addition to the surge capacity of our healthcare institutions, our hospitals in particular. In Florida, we have surge capacity because we deal with hurricanes. So we have emergency management systems that are very sophisticated, and we have surge capacity in our hospitals, but nowhere near the kind of protective equipment that we need or the ventilators. Now, one of the things that Peggy Hamburg and I did in the Clinton administration is we built the stockpile system, and that has been the early responder to this disease, but it's nowhere near as large as we've needed. So we have to go back and build our laboratory systems up, our regional laboratories as well as state laboratories, because most of the states have world-class research universities that actually could do the kind of laboratory testing, as well as look at the private sector for managing the surge capacity that you need. And as you well know, we're now using the private sector testing ability to handle some of this. But investments in our hospital system, in our healthcare system, and of course, we have large numbers of people that still aren't covered by insurance. So we have made the testing free. We have not made the treatment free. For most seniors, they'll be covered by Medicare and Medicaid, depending on their income. But for others, there is a gap there. So we know the gaps. We knew them before. Peggy Hamburg was telling me the other day that she actually, reminding me that we actually did a desktop exercise at the White House on the possibility of a flu pandemic like this. And saw the gaps, but were unable to fill all of them because Congress, you know, if you're not on top of it, we're so reactive in politics here, or there has to be an interest group that surrounds the issue. But we will get it done in the future, let me assure you. That's too long of an answer.
Great. No, that was great. Terrific. Very, very helpful. Thank you, Congresswoman. Another listener asks about your views on stricter measures being taken by countries in Latin America, such as shutting down borders and mandatory lockdowns in order to combat the virus. Do you believe they will be successful in, quote, flattening the curve? Would these measures even be enforceable in the United States?
Well, we're enforcing them in some places. The problem is we can't get the president or all of the governors to do the same thing. You saw what the governors of New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut did. And it looks like they may have slowed things down. All the public health evidence is that this will help, but it's not, but only if it's enforceable. And that is, we have to find a way to do something about people's incomes, about their ability to get food, and to convince them that only as a collective, only as us working together, can we prevent disease. If you look at the 1918 pandemic in the United States, Philadelphia didn't shut down early enough, and in fact had a big celebration in Philadelphia and had a horrendous number of people who died. The city of St. Louis reacted immediately and actually was able to contain So it's the early of the early response, the ability to convince, and this is all about leadership, the ability to convince people that only by working together can we save people's lives. But it bounces up against the economy and the economics. So what we've tried to do in the United States is to handle the economics. People worried about whether they're going to be able to pay their rent or their mortgages or buy food. That's what our recent package did. For the first time, a bipartisan bill made a major investment in unemployment insurance and in small businesses.
Great. Thank you. Why, a listener asked, why and how has this virus in particular had such an extraordinary infection rate and rapid spread compared to other global pandemics that we face, such as SARS or the swine flu? Is it simply because we are a more globalized world today than before, or is this virus itself stronger?
The virus itself is stronger and more deadly. That's the simple answer.
Okay.
It simply is stronger.
Okay, great. Another question. Has there been heightened congressional oversight of the situation facing asylum seekers at our southern border with the onset of COVID-19? Women fleeing violence in their home countries often encounter sexual assault on their journey north, and they are then turned away at our border to face life-threatening conditions in Mexico, including restricted access, reproductive and other health care. These dangers have increased with the spread of COVID-19. Has the Congress responded or is considering some response?
Well, the Democrats have, but we can't convince our colleagues to do much because the president simply does not want to. I'm also concerned about the petri dishes, which are our detention centers, when ICE continues to arrest people and put them in these detention centers. And there's no way to get social distancing in those places. They're overcrowded, and they don't have the same kind of health support, even that some of our prisons do, though those are increasingly petri dishes as well. So frankly, it's a disaster.
Okay. Another question on Central America from one of our listeners. Central America causes considerable consternation on two big issues. First, the fast growth of coronavirus without adequate resources to combat it. And second, continued high levels of illegal immigration. What is needed for Central American countries to form a common market, which would give each country more muscle to deal with both health and economic issues? Should Congress or the administration take a lead to try to encourage each country to become more of a unified market? And if so, how to go about that?
Oh, boy. I'm not sure I believe in individual countries as opposed to as a group banding together. And of course, there are a number of international organizations that think they're doing exactly that, helping people to band together. When I watched the regional approach that the governor of New York had, that's exactly what we've tried to do on the economic side in the Americas. But in Central America in particular, yes, it would help if they got the resources to do that. But that will take more than government. It will take the business community recognizing that they have a stake in both getting supplies, converting factories to get these PPE supplies, and finding a way to create a market that either government or international organizations will pay for as they do supplies. Let me give you a couple of examples. I have in my district, well, my district is a disaster. I have the ports, I have Miami Beach, I have the hotels, I have a hub of American Airlines, I have all of the tourist small businesses. So we have huge unemployment that's descending on us here. But I represent Bacardi, and Bacardi is converting their plants in Florida, Kentucky, and Puerto Rico into providing hand sanitizers because they're in the alcohol business. They're actually producing hand sanitizers they're going to give a lot of this away in Puerto Rico, but there's a market for hand sanitizers. So they're converting their alcohol plant to doing this. And that's both, and that's happening with GE and other companies that are trying to figure out how they can produce ventilators or substitutes for ventilators very quickly. So I think Central America and the business community needs to think of ways, assuming there are markets for purchasing, in which they can provide some of these PPE supplies by converting their factory. That's just
great.
One
Thank
idea.
You. That's great. Very helpful. Thank you. Another question from one of our listeners, what adjustments do international development funders and providers, nonprofits, governments, and for-profits, what are the adjustments they need to make in their operations to respond to COVID-19?
Well, you can see what the Gates Foundation is doing already, but they've been in the infectious disease business for a long time. The not-for-profits, I mean, everybody needs to do their part. And to convert and focus on this particular disease, because what we're trying to do is, number one, to save human lives, but number two, to save the infrastructure for the economy, because we're going to have to recover from this. Both of those take different kind of investments. One of them takes investments in health infrastructures, which certainly not-for-profits have and foundations have worried about for years, and all of them have talked about healthcare infrastructures. And the other is trying to figure out a way to help the economy survive without putting large portions of the population at risk. That's a very tricky business. I'll be interested tonight, CNN is going to have both Tony Fauci and Bill Gates in a town hall meeting. And that should be fascinating for all of us.
Great, thank you. How will this pandemic impact, if at all, the U.S. humanitarian aid to Venezuela?
Well, we have it. It's not going to, I mean, we voted for it, we funded it. A lot of it's sitting on the border in Colombia. The president, as you can tell, is keeping up his pressure on the Venezuelan narco-terrorist government, as he describes it, which is accurate as far as I'm concerned. The one thing I could say to you about that is that the president's leadership on Venezuela, whether he wanted it or not, is very much bipartisan in the Congress. Mario Diaz-Balart, Marco Rubio and I have worked together for years now on keeping the pressure on the Venezuelan government. And all of us in South Florida, all of the Democrats, are deeply committed to a bipartisan strategy. And we have convinced our colleagues who don't have particularly have an interest in Venezuela to vote for humanitarian aid, to denying the Venezuelan government ability to buy military equipment of any kind. And we've kept the pressure on in a bipartisan way. When we passed TPS for Venezuelans, which has not been passed in the Senate, every single Democrat voted for it. And let me assure you, every single Democrat doesn't have a deep interest in Venezuela or even a Venezuelan in their district. But every single one, and we got 39, I think Mario got 39 Republican votes, and many of them were simply but not in districts, you know, in Florida. We got the entire Florida delegation, but some of them just cared about international issues, about the Americas in particular.
Thank you. You touched on this issue before, but another listener, maybe you can go a little bit deeper into this. The measures that Latin American governments can take to avoid a complete spread of the coronavirus in their prisons and guarantee human rights of detained persons. Possible options include early release of low-risk prisoners, release of pretrial detainees, alternatives to detention like house arrest, et cetera. And what role, if any, can the U.S. play in this regard?
Well, I think that all of those are strategies that have been discussed and tested in the international community. All of them will help. The Latin American prisons are just petri dishes. We know that. Mm-hmm. So we need to get people out of there as soon as possible. And social distancing, as far as I can tell, is not possible unless we reduce the populations in those prisons. And it's not that everybody in the prisons is over 65 and is going to die, but everybody's going to get sick. Mm-hmm. And anyone that has a weakened immune system, which might be a large part of that population, is going to die. So this is about life or death. And this is where both the business community, the faith community, and the leadership of Latin America, of individual countries, need to come together and figure out all of the tools that they can use to reduce the possibility of death in their prisons.
Great, thank you. One listener asked if there's anything on this bill that you said should be approved, the stimulus bill by the House. If there's anything that you would, I assume you're going to vote for it, but is there anything that you would have liked to have seen in it or will maybe try to include in the bill that you think it's lacking?
You know, it's lacking a number of things. It's not a perfect bill. That's why we did Bill 1, Bill 2, and Bill 3. There mm-hmm. will be a Bill 4 and a Bill 5, and I'm hoping that we can make more of a global investment in those future bills. And I'm in conversation with both people on the Foreign Affairs Committee as well as the appropriators to see if we can make a deeper investment. The Congress is very worried about the strength of the CDC, and we've made many of those investments, but our ability to get money around, particularly in the Americas, will be very important in the future. Europe doesn't need our help, but the developing world does, and Latin America in particular. So I think that you will see some more investments if any one of us has something to say. As for the United States of America, we have made testing free, but we have not made treatment free. Some of this is the assumption that Medicare will cover the elderly population, but we're going to have other populations that we need to treat. So what we've done is put more money into the hospitals, but not enough money to offset what their costs are going to be. But that's a fight about universal health care, and it's both an ideological fight as well as a presidential campaign fight. So we got to figure out some way to say it in a bipartisan way in which, and I think the way to do it is actually to focus on local hospitals and local communities, because that will put pressure on all of us, no matter whether we're Republicans or Democrats.
Thank you. Another listener asks that this South American regional coordination has taken place in the context of PROSUR and MERCOSUR, which have at the very least created plans to maintain trade flows among countries. Central America has also expressed interest led by El Salvador. Do you have knowledge of these coordination efforts between these groups? And do you know if PAHO and or the U.S. would be in a position to take a leadership role?
You know, I think the leadership is going to have to come from Central America itself. I think PAHO is overwhelmed and the United States is distracted. And that's a candid answer.
Okay. You had mentioned in your comments to another question that, the COVID-19 vaccine probably might not be ready for another 2 years. As a public health expert, what are some of the barriers that the United States still faces in producing a successful vaccine? Are we coordinating with international partners on this as well?
Yeah, we are coordinating with international partners. In fact, there is a historic international effort to find a vaccine for COVID-19. There's no question about it. There is also an international effort to find treatment. And someone asked me the other day, given the United States' attitude about Cuba, whether we were looking at what the Cubans had developed in terms of the possibility of treatment. We may not, but someone else is that's coordinating with us. So I'm not concerned about our ideology or our politics, our international politics, restricting our access to treatments and clinical trials on treatments because of some country we have an attitude about. Because there is the one thing about science is that that coordination is taking place. And the National Institutes of Health, the CDC, and the FDA are huge players in the international effort.
Great, thank you very much. Congresswoman, I think we've reached toward the end of our, this has been absolutely illuminating and sobering, but I think very informative and very insightful, and we appreciate it. I don't know if you'd like to make any closing remarks, if so.
Well, you know, the president said that he thought he saw a light at the end of the tunnel, and my reaction was he must be going in the wrong direction. I don't see that light yet, but I see a lot of very smart people, scientists, physicians, political leaders that are doing everything they can to follow the evidence. And putting every research, we can't over resource this, both on the economic side or on the health side, from my point of view. And at the end of the day, we will have a stronger nation and a stronger health system. And we'll spend the next decade or so building that in a way in which we don't always have to be reactive as opposed to being proactive and being overly prepared. There's no such thing. So I actually have great confidence in most of our political leaders as well as our healthcare leaders in this country and around the world to get our arms around this and to get the job done and to get our economies back going.
Great. Well, on that optimistic note, I want to thank you again, Congresswoman, for taking time out of your day to engage in this important conversation. And I want to thank all of our listeners who tuned in and submitted questions. I want to give special thanks to Sophia Lalinde of The Dialogue for her hard work in making this event possible, as well as Congresswoman Shalala's staff. We hope you'll join our upcoming events on our COVID-19 series next week. Once again, be sure to visit our new webpage at thedialogue.org/COVID-19 for updates. And please, everyone, take good care and stay healthy. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you.